All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Thanks for coming. I don't know if you're new here or what. Doesn't matter. Everyone is welcome. You know, in that pre-show plug there for my gala in Montreal, I got to be honest with you. I spent years and years wondering if I would ever host a gala in Montreal. I have been on so many galas in Montreal, between Montreal and some of the other franchise outposts of that festival. I've been on so much Canadian television doing comedy. At least four or five galas as just a comic. And I got to be honest with you, I've never seen a clip from one. I've never heard anyone react to one. No one has ever tweeted about them. I don't even know if they exist. Do you tape Canadian television, then it just gets lost into the black hole of Canadian late night TV? I don't know if they're even shown. So my expectations about feedback or about it getting out in the world are low. But I got to be honest with you, I was always jealous, man. I was always like, why can't I do one? Why can't I do one? Because I don't think I could have sold tickets. I don't even know if I'll sell tickets now. Usually these halls are huge. But I'm going to be doing it. I'll be hosting it and bringing up comedians. Finally, my time has come. They booked this 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever. And then COVID happened. But they kept the date. They kept their promise. So I'm going to be doing a gala at the Montreal Comedy Festival. And I don't know. It's not a bucket list thing, but I certainly thought I deserved it when I didn't. So in that way, you know, I no longer gave a shit after a certain point. But when it came around, I'm like, yeah, great. I'm ready for that job. Nothing like deserving it when you didn't. Thinking like you deserved it when you don't. How do you not think that? You know what I mean? If you're going to get through life with any sort of confidence, you've got to think that you deserve it even if you don't. And even if people tell you you don't, and even maybe later you think back on it, like, I couldn't have done that job. I didn't deserve that. No fucking way. Did not have the gravitas to do that thing I thought I should have been able to do when I wanted to do it. But I guess that kind of entitlement, that kind of, I don't know if it's arrogance, but that sort of stubborn insistence that you be reckoned with professionally because you want to and you're ready, is some part of confidence. Obviously, it's also a part of insecurity and obviously a part of not knowing yourself very well. But I think all of those, self-centeredness, all that stuff, I guess, is necessary on some level, and persistence to succeed. You could also blow yourself out pretty early, get prematurely bitter. I tried that, prematurely bitter. I tried that angle for a while. Didn't quite stick. Listen, folks, listen to me. Today on the show, I have comedian Sam J. All right. Now, Sam J was a longtime writer for Saturday Night Live. She's on the new Peacock series, Bust Down. And she has her own late night show, Pause, with Sam J on HBO. I would see her at the Comedy Store when she was in town. And I swear to God, the woman did not talk to me. I didn't know if she didn't like me. We'd be in the green room together, just the two of us. Did not engage. Hi, how are you? Hi. But that was it. No conversation. And when she showed up here, I thought, well, this is going to be awkward because there's no way this person likes me. And she was a completely different person. We discussed it. That aside, I would like to say that this may be a fairly awkward white guy feeling interview. For some of you, I don't know why I'm telling you that, but it was one of those things where I'm like, I watched her show, Pause, with Sam J, and it's really just it opens. I've watched three or four of them, and they just open in her an apartment where it's like almost like this cocktail party salon type of thing with a bunch of primarily black people talking about black stuff, and it was one of those moments where I'm like, holy shit, I am really an old white guy because I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know this conversation. And because a lot of it's young people conversation, but a lot of it is issues that African-Americans face. And I just didn't, I didn't know it because I'm not in the loop. I don't know if I could be in the loop unless I was young and black. But there was sort of an excitement that I had watching the show that I definitely brought into the interview. But I was not nervous, but I was trying to be forthright about my ignorance. And I didn't want to talk too much because God knows, you know, white guys have talked enough. I was excited and white. All right, that excited, nervous, and white, and maybe overcompensating. That's how I feel about it. But maybe we'll see. We'll see how you feel about it. But I definitely enjoy talking to Sam Jay. Holy fuck. I was in a hotel room in Laconia, New Hampshire. And I decided to check in with the world via my TV in my room. And I was flipping around, and I was on HBO 2, maybe, one of the HBOs. And I was just in the, I clicked into the middle of a episode of Euphoria. And I didn't know what the fuck I was watching. I kind of heard about it, but I didn't know. I didn't read any press on it. I don't know. I'm getting further out of the loop. But Jesus, man, I watched 4 episodes of Euphoria in a row from the second season, having seen none of them. And I was like, have I never watched television before? Or better yet, is this what television is now? When did this happen? When did this become television? What the fuck am I watching? Holy shit. Did I feel like an old guy? Yeah. But within minutes, I felt like a dirty old guy. I was like, am I supposed to even be watching this? Is this what the kids are doing? Where the fuck? What is happening? It was like that, man. Is it like that? It was like that. Did I stop watching? No, I was like completely engaged. I just could not believe what I was watching. Drugs and sex. It was sweaty. That whole show is sweaty. But I really thought I had missed a decade or two. And then I realized, like, this is the kind of show this is why they hate us. If there's a reason why Hollywood is threatening, it's that show. They're like, look at what they're doing. Oh, my God. I'll tell you, I went back. I just started watching it from the beginning because I figure I can only handle one episode a day. It's so shattering and raw and fucking weird. And like, is that what high school is like now? And also, like, if there's a balance being sought for you know, decades, I guess since probably the 60s or 70s of boobs, of TNA, tits and ass, and merkined vaginas on screen, well, this show is balancing out the cock factor. There's just a, like, a avalanche of dick in Euphoria. So I think there's an effort being made on behalf of Hollywood to balance the dick quota with about 3 or 4 decades of boobs and vaginas and asses. So now just full on dick, full frontal dick, a lot of it. Apparently some of it is fake, but I mean, who cares? Doesn't really matter, does it? Dick's a dick, right? A lot of dick. Anyway, my mind was kind of blown by youth culture and by black youth culture in the last month. You know, before talking to Sam Jay from watching Pause, I learned some things and I felt like a old white guy. And from watching Euphoria, I learned some things and felt like just an old guy and a slightly dirty old guy. Is that what the show's trying to do? To make us all feel a little dirty of a certain age? What are people doing with that show? How are people handling it? I got to go do some research. Anyway, look, I'm no prude, but wow, what is happening? What's going on in this world? So the first season of Bust Down, this is Sam's new show. Again, this is a show that seems funny. I'm not sure I understand it. And it's not a black thing. It's just an old guy thing, I think. Look, it takes me a minute sometimes with comedy, certainly with sketch or with absurd comedy, to figure out what the fuck is going on. But I get it. I usually get around to it. It hits me all at once. But the first season of Bust Down is now streaming on Peacock. Season 2 of Pause with Sam Jay is coming to HBO in May. You can stream all of season 1 on HBO Max. That's where Euphoria is, too. I'm just saying. Be careful, though. It's going to turn your brain out, man. Anyway, I don't want to distract from this intro. But I will say this. Euphoria will turn your brain out. I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to be the same again. So this is me talking to Sam J. Nice to see you.
It's nice to see you too, man.
You look dressed up.
I'm really?
Everything matches.
I just, you know, tried to just throw something more real quick.
Oh, really?
Something I didn't have to think about. Yeah.
How long are you in town for?
I'm here till Wednesday.
And you're just doing press for the new thing?
Yeah, well, we're having a premiere party tonight for Bust Down.
Yeah.
So that's why I came in town. And then I've been wanting to do this, so we made sure this could happen while I was here.
Oh, I'm glad it happened. Yeah. I started to think, like, does she even like me? I see at the Comedy Store, I couldn't get a read on anything. I'm like, I don't even know if she wants to talk to me at all.
Yeah, everyone kind of picks up that vibe for me. I'm hard to read, I guess.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't, you know, it's one of those things where you hear it enough that you're like, it must be true, but you don't think that's what you're giving off.
Well, I mean, that must be just the zone you're in when you're out there doing that. Because I, you know, I watched several episodes of Pause and I'm like, I never met that lady. How come I never talked to that
Everybody
lady?
Everybody says that. You're not the first person to say that.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think it is?
I don't know. I mean,
like, because it's, I only see you right before you're going on stage.
Yeah, I think it's that. And then it's like with Pause, I'm really with my friends.
Are they all your real friends?
They're all like my real friends, at least this last season. I think it's going to be a little bit more mixed up this season.
Really?
But last season, they were all comics I was really cool with and people like I actually knew.
It's so funny because I had some observations about, you know, because obviously after watching it and after my own sort of insecurity, I assume that, you know, I'm just not relevant to that conversation. and I'm probably not. You know, I'm just, you know, another sort of, you know, cis middle-aged white guy trying to be relatively decent in the modern culture. So there's part of me that's always like, well, there's no reason for any of them to talk to me. And I, not by them, I mean you or black people, but just just young people.
I get what you say.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for real.
It's a whole generation of people. I don't know what the hell's going on with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I feel you because I look at my little cousins and I feel the same way. I'm like, I don't
really
know. Yeah.
What do you mean little?
Like, you know, early 20s, you know,
oh, really?
To mid 20s. I'm like, I don't know.
There's already a big.
I don't know.
You don't
know what I mean? No
you
idea.
Don't.
I can listen to
it. Are you concerned?
Not really. I feel like every generation figures it out for themselves.
I guess, but like now it just, there just seems to be so much, so it's almost become tribalized. Like, you know, yeah, generationally we all kind of figure it out, but culturally it seems like things are like in some sort of fucked up shift. There's a fight on.
There is. There's a little bit of a digging of the heels in the sand moment happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when I see you and your friends, it's just so funny how there is a New York thing with certain people.
Yeah, yeah, it's an East Coast thing. I think in Boston we got a little bit of that as well amongst the people of color. And then the whites in Boston, that's a whole nother bag of worms. Amongst the black people.
Wait, you came up in Boston?
I'm from Boston.
You're from Boston?
Yeah.
Wow. Where'd you grow up?
Dorchester.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Man, I spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, I know.
I came up there. I was having flashbacks just when I went on that road gig. Driving to New Hampshire, I'm like, fuck. You like that feeling of driving to a gig, like, I don't even know what this is. What am I walking into? I don't know if you did that kind of stuff.
No, for sure. I remember my first gigs, like, in New Hampshire. Like,
right.
I was really desperate to do comedy, so, like.
Who was booking it?
This dude named Nick LaValle was booking everything. Uh-huh. He had, like, the Shaskeen, and he had, like, another room, and I was desperate to just do stand-up.
Right.
And Boston's very white, so there also wasn't a lot of black people.
Weird white.
Doing stand-up. Yeah, so.
It's a unique white up there.
Yeah, so I ended up cool with a lot of, like, white boys, but not really cool. We were just, like, cool by necessity of us all trying to do it then.
Yeah.
And I'm in my first trip to New Hampshire. I'm riding in a car with this white boy I barely know, and it's just getting darker and woodsier, and I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, this is crazy.
I used to feel that by myself. And it had nothing to do with color. It was just me panicking. Like, what is this even a real place, this gig?
And then you don't know what you're going to get. You're going to get a room for, like, New Hampshire people.
Nothing. You don't
know
nothing.
And then I'm going to get up there and do my thing.
Right.
And it's like, how is that all going to go?
Yeah. Well, that's how I learned. That's how. I did feel that panic when I was driving from Troy, New York to Laconia, New Hampshire. I went into a spiral where I text my agent. I'm like, how the fuck did you even find this gig? What the fuck am I doing? I'm beyond this. But then I got there and they were, it was a nice little theater. They were there to see me. That's the difference. And they were, it wasn't just some random comedy night at some dump. So you were born in Boston?
I was born in Georgia, but I moved to Boston before I was even a year old. I don't remember even living in Georgia.
So your family moved there?
My mom sent me up. It was a little bit of a crazy story. My dad had passed away like maybe a month or 2 months after I was born.
Really?
My dad had a heart attack. And then my mom ended up getting into this custody battle with his mom because she was trying to get custody of me to like...
Your grandmother.
Yeah, but I never met this woman my whole life. But she was trying to get custody of me to like get the money my dad had left me.
It wasn't because she cared.
And my dad never had like a real relationship. So my mom, out of fear of like the way Georgia's kind of backwards, she sent me to Boston while she fought the case. And I lived with my grandmother and my aunt.
While
I was a baby.
Uh-huh.
And then once the stuff was all over, her and my brothers came up to Boston.
How many brothers?
Two.
Oh, and it was in Dorchester.
Yeah.
At that time, so that like... What part of Dorchester? Like towards Columbia Point?
Nah, like towards
Mattapan.
Right. Like towards Mattapan, Blue Hill Live, Franklin Park.
Yeah. I went to school in Milton for a year, so
it was
right on Mattapan.
Yep.
But like I've never been to a more segregated city in my life.
Yeah.
Have you?
No. It's weird, and like I was just home because we're shooting an episode of Pause in Boston this season.
Really?
And it was a little embarrassing, I'm not going to lie, because I'm so used to it. But watching other people navigate it and be like, how do you... Then it was like, damn, this is kind of fucked up. But I'm so used to it.
Right.
It's like you don't clock it till you're with a bunch of people who aren't.
And what was their reaction to
what?
They
just... You know, like the Teamsters that were driving the car were pretty racist, and they were, you know, we were doing stuff in the neighborhoods I grew up in, and they were saying stuff like, oh, you might want to duck, and are you sure you want to shoot here, and you don't know what's going to happen when the cameras come out, they might try to steal them, just crazy stuff that's not like real. And then they just noticed how separated it was and just how the white people in Boston are, and it's like, this is all stuff I can shrug off and just move through because I grew up like that. But to watch other people navigate it was a little bit like, damn, this sucks.
Yeah, when I was there, I got used to it because I had to sort of roll with it because all the comics were kind of like Irish white dudes.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to, but I had this real paranoia of Irish dudes for a long time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because like I was just this aggravated, neurotic, angry Jewish guy running to these one-nighters. And I definitely wasn't the same as them.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel that difference even if it's that. And I was always a little nervous, but I grew to like a lot of the comics and learn a lot from them, but I did realize as time went on that this, like, that city really hides its black people.
Yeah. That's what I've always said about Boston. We live in a certain corner of the city, and if you don't know where we are, you'll never find us. And like,
it's crazy.
It's really wild. Like, I used to work, and, you know, black people usually work downtown, and then we go to our homes, you know,
back.
Dorchester, Mattapan, Roxbury, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember one time I worked at the aquarium at the time. And this black family, they were from Detroit. They walked up to me and they were like, yo, could we ask you a question? I was like, you want to know where the black people are, huh? And they were like, yes. And I was like, all right, this is what you got to do. You got to go here.
Here's
here,
the map.
Here's how you find us. They were like, because this is crazy. I was like, yeah, you know, but I don't even, it's another one of those moments where it's like, I don't think about it because I'm so used to it. But to people coming in, it probably looks nuts.
But I guess, oddly, you know, that's the way it was, you know, always.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't different until years, but Boston never really changed. I never, like, even New York, I mean, you have black neighborhoods, but that city feels integrated to
me. Boston doesn't feel like that.
No, man.
I always say it's Atlanta for white people. I've heard other people say it too, but.
Atlanta for white people?
Yeah, I've been saying it for a long time. It's Atlanta for white people.
Well, there's this idea that it's some sort of progressive place, but that's only relative to the transient population of like 300,000 students and colleges each year. I mean, in and of itself, it's pretty provincial and pretty New England.
I mean, I believe that New England is like the last white haven. You know what I mean? It's just like, if you just want to be white and just only see, that's where you go. You know what I mean? I used to do this joke
a long time ago.
I used to do this joke in New Hampshire. Like, you know it's white when the white people are pumping the gas. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't even got black people working in the kitchen. It's like, this is white through and through.
Well, it's beat up, man. I mean, you drive through that state and it was like, wow. I mean, a lot of, you know, dead barns.
It's not a lot going on,
No, and you just feel the weight of it, the weight of the depression of it.
That was like one of the first times, like, I got a homies from New Hampshire his name, Justin Pieger. And like, that's the, like, thing I'm always, I always talk about, like white people be poor, bro.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like just as much as, like, Boston hides its black people, I feel like white people in general hide their poor. Like,
well, that's why no one talks about class in this country.
Yeah.
It's because, you know, poor white people think they're just about to be rich.
Yeah. And I'm like, white people be poor. Because I remember going to New Hampshire, bro. Yeah. And they was heating a house off of, like, a wood stove. Yeah. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. Yo.
Yeah. No, that's true.
This is wild up here.
So when did you start doing comedy? Did you go to school in Boston? What was the whole trip over there like?
Man, I graduated high school, of course, and then I stayed there.
In Mattapan?
No, Roxbury. New Mission High School in Roxbury. Yeah. And I stayed in Boston for like 2 years. And then I went away to Georgia to go to school. I tried comedy in those 2 years. I tried it like twice.
In Atlanta?
In Boston. Oh, right before I left, I tried it like 2 times. I went up at Dick Doherty's room.
And Dick Doherty. You're funny. You're insecure. That's what he said to me. You're insecure.
It was And then I went to Atlanta, and my mom had passed when I was in high school, 16 and stuff. So then I went to Atlanta. I kind of spiraled out. I was like drinking too much and partying too much and not really going to school. And I wasn't really doing much of anything, working a bunch of odd jobs.
What was it like? Were you out and having fun?
I came out in Atlanta about 24. Yeah, and then I was out having fun.
Well, yeah, because Atlanta is a pretty good gay town.
Black and gay.
Yeah. Because
nice.
When I used to stay there, there's that huge gay club right there in downtown. It seemed like it was all black and all fun. Like big lines outside.
All
of it.
Black and all fun.
I just see the lines going in.
Downtown, like, was it Bulldogs?
It was maybe. It was right around the corner. It was kind of by Laughing Skull. Right?
Bulldogs.
Yeah. It's on that street. One of the peach trees.
Yeah, Bulldogs. Probably.
Yeah. But every time I looked, I was sort of like, wow, that's where it's happening.
I had a lot of fun in Atlanta.
So, all right. So you tried it in Boston at the Vault. Was it at Dick Doherty's Comedy Vault?
Yep.
And then you went down to Atlanta and you got all fucked up?
Got all fucked up.
What kind of jobs were you doing?
Every dumb thing. I worked at a Starbucks, bro. I worked for the state doing taxes. At one point, I was like working for the census. It was just like whatever I could do, just flipping jobs. Hated everything I was doing.
And were you getting, because your mom passed and you didn't know what you were doing, so you're just rudderless? And doing, mm-hmm. How fucked up did you get? Was it, like, trouble fucked up?
It was bad I think, outside looking in, it was just like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen with this girl. Like, she's not really making anything of her life. But for me, it was dark because I knew how I was feeling, and I was feeling real lost. You know what I mean? I knew internally what was happening with me. It was real dark for me on my side of it.
So you didn't know if you're going to get out or not?
I didn't see a way out. I couldn't, you know what I mean? I couldn't see a way through it at all.
A mixture of depression and just using shit.
Depression and you know, drinking too much and feeling like I'm not living with any purpose and knowing that there is some purpose out there, but it's like I can't touch it or see it.
Right.
It just seems like I'll never get to it. So then it's like that hopelessness.
Yeah.
On top of that, it's just like, I guess this is gonna be my life, just like doing things I hate for damn near no money to barely survive, to go back and do something I hate, and really not seeing a way out of that and kind of giving up. Like, well, if this is it, then I might as well just get drunk and like, find the fun where I can, because this fucking sucks.
It's the worst. Because it's like, it's just this, when I started the podcast, I was pretty down and I didn't know what I was going to do or how it was going to unfold. And I thought, like, I couldn't sell tickets. I was in my 40s and I was like, fuck, I'm going to be one of those guys.
Yeah.
Doing those gigs.
Yep.
And it's horrible because, like, either you surrender to the disappointment and to the managing that, or you're like, I'm fucking out.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill myself.
It's scary, bro. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. People don't get it. It's like...
What's the point of living?
It's a low. It's a suicidal low. Yeah. And it's like, you know, I never attempted suicide.
Sure.
But I definitely was feeling like...
Yeah.
If I die, I don't even care, bro. Like, I just...
I used to...
It felt pointless.
Right. I used to do a joke about that. It's like, I think about suicide all the time. It's not because I want to kill myself. I just find it relieving to know that I can if I have to.
Yeah. If it comes down to it, I'm going to do it.
It's when you're finding peace in that, you know...
You're in a bad spot.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So what shifted? What changed? What was there a white light moment? Was there like, oh my God?
I think it was like several fucking moments.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It was just like... seeing how my life was just going, you know, and not, and just being like, I can't give up. I always, you know, God bless my mother. I think a lot of her lessons and things that she gave me when it was at its darkest hour, I was able to pull on them.
Like what?
To find myself, just to like, honestly, just to believe in myself. And my mother used to always tell me, like, there's no shortcuts to life, you know? Like,
you
can't skip a step. And like, it's whatever it is, you're going to pull it from yourself. So if you don't achieve something, it's because of you. She never let me like lean on race or anything. And I'm not knocking one. I'm just saying like, that's not how I was raised. It was just kind of like, yeah, it's going to be harder for you or things may get in your way. But at the end of the day, you determine your life. And if you don't pull yourself up and do the shit, then it ain't going to get done.
Right.
And you can only look at yourself to blame. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So. I was like just digging into those lessons and kind of seeing some shit come full circle. I ended up sleeping on the couch of a homie and they had a roommate that I never saw. But then the day I finally saw him, it was a dude who used to sleep on my couch. And so it's like, all right, we're having some full circle moments that are really kind of fucked up right now.
The sad full circle.
Yeah, like this isn't good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And just kind of these things that kind of pushed me in. A dude put a gun to my head. And
that sounds a transitional moment.
And I was just kind of like, if that, and I really thought I was going to die, you know? And I remember just feeling like, bro, this can't be the Samaria Johnson story.
What was
just a kid sticking up. My brother and I used to always play cards in his garage, and I think he thought it was a gambling house.
Yeah.
And he just came in to like rob it, grab me and put a gun in my head. And he eventually just got scared and ran off. But I just remember being like, this can't be the tale.
No.
This can't be how it all goes down.
Yeah.
So it's like little things that kind of just like got me up off my ass.
And you decided to go back to Boston?
Go back to Boston.
You weren't doing any comedy down there?
No.
In Atlanta?
No. I tried it the year, like that, after Dude Put a Gun On, like that January, around like that new year. I was like, I'm gonna try this. And I was turning 28 and I was like, yeah, I'm gonna try it. I tried it in Atlanta and I was like, okay.
Where? Punchline or Laughing Skull?
Star Bar.
Huh, I don't know that.
That was like right across the street from Laughing Skull. It was this little open mic they do on like Mondays or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I think this is it. But I was like, I can't do it in Atlanta because I did a lot of shit in Atlanta and I was doing music shit. And I just felt like people weren't gonna let me redefine myself.
Yeah.
And be something else. And I wanted the space to figure out
the people you were hanging around with.
Yeah, I wanted space to just really figure out who I was in this thing.
Sure.
And plus, I just needed to go home and tap in with my family. After my mother died, it was estranged and crazy. And
what happened?
Think that was a part of just people die. And I think families, sometimes they come together and sometimes they go to their mutual corners. And my mom was kind of integral to my family.
The center of the wheel.
Yeah. And it kind of just split us up in a way. And we were a very close knit family. So it was super hard on me.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like I could navigate Boston comedy.
Yeah.
Like I really thought about it. And once I really decided I wanted to do it, I was really like, thinking about how I was going to execute it.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I know home. I know I can get on trains and buses for fairly cheap to get to play. Like in Atlanta, I got to drive everywhere. I can't even afford a car.
Yeah.
So it's like, if I really want to do this, I need to be in a city that I can get to these things.
Yeah.
I know I can get a job. Like Boston's pretty, you can get your shit together there.
Right.
Kind of easily.
Yeah, yeah.
So I knew I could get on my feet and get a job and be able to get to shows and do all that kind of stuff. And also I had my family there. So it's like, there's only so far I'm going to fall, and I can really kind of throw myself into this thing and really try it.
They're not going to let you get lost again.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. So
were they relieved when you came back?
I think so.
Where they were like, oh, we didn't know if you were going
to. I think so. Yeah. I think they were glad I was back. But then, you know, at first they just trying to force their agenda. You know, my aunt's trying to get me to drive the bus. My aunt's been driving the T for like 30 years now. So
they get worried, right? They're like, well, you got to get a pension.
Yeah,
get you a hospital job
or get you you know, those are like the Boston jobs.
Sure.
Or whatever. But I was like, I was really determined at that point to really try to do stand up.
Well, that's interesting because now you can be, you know, your cafeteria lady on the show. So you're able to do one of those jobs fictional.
Yeah, which was like fucking hell. I'm not going to lie. It brought me back. It was a little like, at one point I had to take off that apron and I was like, oh, this sucks.
This could have been it.
Yeah. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
So, all right. So when you start doing it there, like I don't, there in my life, in my generation, I can't really remember. I'm really trying to remember any black comics from my generation. Like I'm coming up in Boston in the late 80s. And I can't remember any. Isn't that fucked up?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them were there then for you and your crew? I mean, I know Patrice is from there, but who else is from there?
Well, you know, there's like Corey Rodriguez, and it was my homie Tawanda, and it was Nick. Like, there was, we were out there, you know?
Yeah.
It definitely was way more white dudes than us, and they definitely were getting, like, the preference for sure.
Sure, yeah.
But there, we were there, you know what I mean? We were there.
It's interesting to me that there's always been, even when I started, there was a world of black comedy that we didn't know about, and it was full.
Yeah.
And there was just two different worlds, man. And then you'd see it on TV, or you'd run, and you'd be like, oh my God, there's all these cats. But now even that's a little, I think, a little more integrated.
Yeah, a little more, And I think it's more like people stopped following the rules. Like, black people stopped being like, oh, I gotta go just do the black clubs. Like, no, I'm gonna do every club, you know?
Did you do black clubs?
Yeah, I did. There was a one night a week that was a black night in Boston on Wednesdays at this bar called Slade's in Roxbury that was run by this dude named Jonathan Gates. And he was actually the first person to tell me I was a headliner. He was the first person to pay me to do stand-up.
Oh, really?
He was the first person to really give me time on stage.
Yeah.
I remember he got a knee surgery and he left me his room. I was broke. I had just quit my job because I went to go do Bridgetown and they wouldn't give me the time off. So when I came back, I had nothing. He let me host his room. He let me host his room for like four weeks. Just took his room over. And he paid me every week.
Oh, that's great. It was so you can work out all that shit, get up and down.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was really cool. And then I did all the other rooms, the Knicks and the comedy studios and all the other stuff as well.
That was okay, the comedy studio.
I did the white rooms first. I went to Slade's
Jenkins room?
Last. Yeah.
Rick Jenkins, wasn't that his? The comedy studio in
still
Cambridge?
Still his.
Yeah. And Knicks, like, Knicks is different now, but when I was there, that was, like, you know, that was rough, man.
Oh, no.
You got to fight it out.
Bro, Knicks is, like, when we was doing it, man, in the winter, they would have a space heater on the stage because they wouldn't, like, heat the
In the one downtown?
Yep. It got crazy.
It got bad, I guess. That place
crazy.
When I was there at the peak in Boston, Knicks was running two or three shows in the same room, in the same building.
Yeah.
Because they had that nightclub downstairs and the main showroom upstairs, and you could go back and forth. And there might have even been a third one.
Nah.
And then there was like one in the Kowloon, and then there was, but that's still, I think that just closed, right?
Kowloon? No, he just was there.
Oh,
I just took the crew there to eat when we were up there scouting for Paws.
Well, I mean, is there still comedy show though?
No, I think kidding. So. They
it's
still
a big
had it.
Room, man.
They still had it like
Did you
set
play
up.
That one?
Never. That lady didn't like me.
Oh, shit.
Nope.
the woman who booked the Knicks? Did you ever do Mike Clack's room?
Nope.
Giggles? You ever do Giggles?
Nope. No. Really? I left before I got, like, he started to know who I was, and then I, like, moved type of thing.
Yeah. But you did do the one-nighters, though, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely there doing comedy.
So how long were you doing it there?
I was in Boston maybe 2-3 years.
Okay. So you got some time together?
Yep.
And you got your chops?
Yep.
And then you went to New York?
I went to L.A.
Oh, you came here first?
Yeah.
Did you get beat up or what happened? did it chew you up, spit you out?
In L.A.?
Yeah.
No.
That first time? No? You did all right?
Nah, I did all right. I came to L.A. and things kind of moved fairly quickly when I got here.
So it's not a bad L.A. story?
No. Oh. It was like a scene of young people, and like it was dope. Like the energy was dope.
Well, how'd you like what? How did what was your entree into L.A.? Did you do Montreal? Were you known? Were people already, you know?
I was doing like I did Bridgetown. That was my first like festival, and at the time, Bridgetown was like a big festival on, especially for West Coast because
the one in Portland
because all the like. Reps and stuff from Cali, like LA, would just go up there.
Oh, so that was because all the other festivals got turned out. Like everybody knew who everybody was, and there was no real reason to go to Montreal other than for agents to get fucked up with producers.
Yeah.
So Bridgetown was sort of like, we don't know any of these people.
Yeah, it was like, who's the new.
Right.
The new people.
So that was happening. And there's all those weird bars that you would play in.
Yep.
I remember doing Bridgetown and we were on a patio and it was raining and it was leaking through.
Yeah. It's a wild time. We're doing like parking lot shows then like a show in front of a taco truck and then like a show inside and then like, but I was having a blast, you know what I mean? And that's where I met my manager and there was a lot of like Comedy Central people there.
Who's the manager?
Kara Baker at Avalon.
I'm at Avalon.
Yeah.
I know Kara.
I love her. Yeah. She's the best. And so we did all that, you know what I'm saying? And then, so I just made, and there was a lot of like West Coast comics there. So I just made a lot of connections that way. And so.
Like who'd you meet?
Oh, Jack Knight.
Oh, you met Jack there?
I met Jack at Bridgetown. Yeah. Yep.
Where's he come from?
Seattle.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I met Jack there. I met Nori Davis who lives in New York. I met I want to say I met Taylor Tomlinson there.
Yeah.
I met so many people there.
Oh, so that's
Tone
great.
Bell. I met some Clayton English. I met so many people at Bridgetown. Dulce Sloan. And so after that, I just was like, well, it seems like L.A. is where I can kind of move around, you know? Yeah. And also, I felt like New York was too close to Boston, and I was going to go home a lot.
Yeah.
And just, and like, lean on a crutch. And I just wanted to be somewhere where I had to, like, figure it out.
But it must have been a relief to see all these different people and to see comedy thriving on all different levels coming from all different points of view. Mm-hmm. Because, like, the one thing about coming up in Boston or even growing up in Boston is it's a box.
Yep.
And it's limited. And then to go out there and just be like, holy shit, you know, this is all happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt like, here's a chance to really take a huge step that could, like, change some shit for you.
That's good. So you really had it together enough to make those decisions. That's good.
I was older, though. You know, I always credit this. I was just older. Like, at that point, I'm 29.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I got some sense about myself, just period, you know?
So you go to L.A.?
Go to L.A. I get Comics to Watch, Comedy Central's Comics to Watch at New York Comedy Festival, maybe, like, 3 months into being in L.A. So I go out there to do that. I do well at that. Then I get the call to do Montreal, maybe.
New Faces?
Yep. Yeah. Maybe a few months later from that, I do New Faces. I had a really good showing at New Faces.
Yeah.
So I was only in LA 2 years. Then some people from SNL saw me there.
Yeah.
They asked me to audition in LA. I auditioned in LA. Then they flew me out to New York to audition in front of Lauren. I did. Then they called me and asked me if I wanted to have a writing job. So I was like, oh, they must think I'm ugly and fat. But they think I'm funny enough to do something. So
but
I took the job.
But were you a character person?
Nah, I wasn't. Yeah. I just did stand up. And at the end of the day, like, you know, we were talking about me moving the cast and then some other things happened or whatever. But I always felt like that was their intention. And like, they were very forward of like, we just want you to learn the system and figure it out.
So tell me how that went. The process of SNL, because I talk to people about that. Like, you know, so who calls you to offer you the writing job?
Kenward, Eric Kenward.
Okay. And when do you meet Lauren?
Like, really actually meet Lauren?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Did you already have the job? Or did you have to go meet him to talk about that?
No. I think you go, right?
Yeah.
I went. You still have to, like, sit with him.
Right.
You have to sit at the desk and he kind of like talks to you about your future and your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like,
you did that.
Did that thing.
And how was that?
It was cool.
Did he make you wait?
Of course.
Yeah. Why is that such a thing?
Of course.
How many hours? How many hours?
Ah, man. I don't want to lie because Lauren, I love me some Lauren.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But it was over two. It was over 2 hours for sure.
But you knew that going in.
Yeah.
Was anyone sort of advising you, you know, going into
that? Well, at the time I was at ICM and I had an agent named Ayala Cohen who, she used to work there.
Yeah.
So she was super familiar with the process.
Right.
So she kind of held my hand through it and I thank God for her, for real. Because there was some times where that show like was breaking me and I'd be like,
So you meet with Lauren, you get the job, you take the gig. Who's the cast? What year is this?
Chris Red's first year. Me and Chris were friends before.
Okay. Oh, you were from
comedy? So we went to SNL together. Yeah.
Okay.
We both were living in LA and we moved to New York at the same time.
Yeah.
Called each other like, did you get it? I got it type of shit.
Oh, okay.
So Chris Red, this is Chris Red's first year.
Yep.
Who, 80s there, of course. Che's there, of course. Kenny's there, of course. Kate's there, of course.
Uh-huh.
There was some Luke Knowles first year.
Okay.
Luke Knowles first year.
So what'd you learn going in? What was your approach?
I kind of approached it like you approach stand up, right? Just like get in, try to get in where you fit in, be observant.
Did you latch on to like figure out how to write for people?
I didn't know how to do anything. I'd never written before. This is my first writer's job.
Yeah.
And I'd never written a sketch.
How the fuck did you get the job then?
I don't know.
Wild.
I did some stand-up.
Yeah. That's interesting, though, that, like, you've never written you don't come from sketch, you come from stand-up. Yeah, I wonder, like, do you ever think about, like, what did they see that, like, made them believe that, like, this person's a sketch writer, she just doesn't know it yet?
I don't know, man. That's some of, like, you know, some people love to hate him, but I really think that's the brilliance of Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
It's like, He knows who can do it.
No one hates him on the mic.
He has a good sense of like who can do it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
did you feel like you got the hang of it?
Yeah. But I mean, I wrote there for 3 years. Yeah. So by like the first year, hell, you know? And it wasn't really till the end of the first season that I was like, oh, I think I get how to do this some kind of way. You know what I mean? And then by season two, by the middle, and I had kind of really connected with the dude, my writing partner there, Gary Richardson, and we had really figured out a flow and a style.
Was it you guys decided on the partnership? You just came together?
It just kind of came together. We were the only two black writers at the time, me and Gary. Oh. And one day we got our residuals. It was like the middle of the first season, and we got residual checks. Yeah. And I didn't even know about these residual checks. I didn't know. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And this lady just came and threw a bunch of free money on my desk. Yeah, and I was like, oh, shit. This is fucking crazy. And Gary came in my office, and he was like, yo, did you? It was like our first time jamming. He was like, do you want to try to jam on this thing? I was like, yeah. And he was like, also, bro, they just giving niggas money. And I was like, yeah, okay. You a real nigga too. All right. We could probably figure something out. This is crazy, right? And we kind of just connected in that moment of being like two black people like, this is fucking wild, that it just from there kept flowing. And then once I figured that out and really found my sketch voice and learned how to cast sketches, because all that stuff is a part of it. Like,
so you actually act as your own segment producer?
Yeah, 100%.
Right.
Che taught me a lot too when I was drowning. You know?
Like what was the drowning like? What brought that on? Just
being bad at it, man. Oh. I don't know how to write sketches. And then they go to the table and they get read out loud and they ask, you know, and all you hearing is the pages turn, you know what I mean? And you're feeling hella embarrassed and like people are killing because they know what they're doing, and you're just like, am I ever going to figure out how to fucking do this?
Taking
and
also, the hit.
Yeah, Chris is also like a peer of mine. We do stand up together, Che's a peer, so I'm failing in front of my fucking friends.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like...
And Che, what, reached out or he stepped... How did that
work? Just talked to me one day. He was like, yo, just pay attention to the table. He's like, you're not doing bad. You know, it feels like you're doing terrible.
Uh-huh.
But he's like, you're not doing bad, you know, like... It ain't it, but it ain't bad. He's but you know, when you're not getting shit on, don't get caught up in not getting shit on.
Yeah.
Just pay attention to the table. You know what I'm saying? And listen and watch and listen to what sketches are working. So I started doing that, and I started like keeping the sketches I liked that were working and reading them again and figuring out like moves and like also figuring out who likes what, figuring out how to cast. Like, oh, Kate's really strong in these type of characters.
Yeah.
80s, because that also could fuck your sketch up. I was casting my sketches all wrong.
Right.
I was just throwing names out. I wasn't thinking about the person and how they were going to do it, you know?
So you're learning how the all levels of the production work.
Yeah.
The, you know, casting, understanding people's limitations and where their strengths are, you know, how to, you know, tag a sketch. Mm-hmm. So it's all coming together.
Yeah, it's just all coming together.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And then also, once I separated myself from trying to beat it, I think that's how it gets a lot of people going, and they're like, I'm gonna fucking beat this thing. It's like, nah, you're just really a cog in the wheel of a thing that's gonna keep going with or without you. And then I started to just try to figure out how to be useful.
Right.
So if I didn't get a sketch on, I'll still help other people with their sketches, or I'll watch the sketches and be like, yo, I saw this thing, or I knew you wanted it to look like this, but it didn't look like this. It kind of came off like that. Just figured out ways to be useful within the thing.
The community.
In the community, and then thus people would help me, and like it kind of like...
Yeah. It's like when someone comes up to you, it's like, you take tags? I got a tag for you. You want a tag?
Yeah.
You're like, what is it? And you're like, oh, that's good.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the same thing as comedy. I had to learn how to play with them, you know, because I'm not an improviser, and they have a lot more energy and they're a lot more cheery than like us,
But you're engaged.
Yeah. But I just didn't know how to... I know how to riff with comics. I didn't know how to do the thing with them.
Collaborate with people.
I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah, we're not collaborators.
So I would like write shit, and then like Beck would come up to me in the hall and be like, Sam. And he'd just start doing a voice. And I'd just be looking at him like, nigga, what the fuck is you doing? Like, I don't... Go ahead, do whatever. Like, if that's what you want to do, do it. And I didn't realize he needs me to like give him something so he can... I had to learn like, oh, this is how they play, and this is how they figure out how to do their thing.
Give me something to work with.
Yeah, I would just be staring like, I guess, bro, you know.
And they're looking for support and leadership. And you're like, I don't know.
I'm like, this nigga weird, you know. Just going in my office. It's like, that ain't it.
But you figured it out. Which were your big sketches?
The John Mulaney Cha-Cha Slide sketch that I wrote with Brian Tucker.
Yeah.
The...
Tucker's been there forever.
Yeah. The Chadwick Boseman Black Panther, Black Jeopardy.
Oh, yeah.
Eddie Murphy Black Jeopardy.
Did you get to meet Eddie and deal with Eddie at all?
Yeah. That was crazy. That was a crazy. That was a crazy.
Did you look up to that guy?
Of course.
Who were your comic heroes?
Major way.
Yeah, Eddie.
In a major way. I don't know. I was born in 82. You know, I don't know a black kid in the '80s who didn't think that he was fucking God.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy Week. My aunt called me like, "Are you crying? Because I know that's dislike your God."
Yeah. And you got him at a good time. He's kind of nice, sweet.
Yeah, he's chilling. Yeah, it was really cool to have a job in common with Eddie Murphy, where he was like sitting in the office being like, this is how my office was set up, and talking about the show and like, is it still like this? And do this still happen? And we're like, yeah, they still do that, but they don't do this. And like,
right.
I was like, this is like crazy.
It's wild, right? Yeah, and you know what's amazing about him? I think it probably, you probably saw it a lot though, because there's a few people on SNL that can do that, is how easily he can turn on the funny part. Like, he doesn't exist in it, but like, if he needs it, he throws a switch and it's there.
Yeah.
Old Eddie is right there. That time he hosted, it was crazy.
Yeah.
That sketch at the end, what was it, a hurricane sketch?
Yeah.
It was
with
crazy.
With the elf.
Yeah. Because he was just like Old Eddie.
Yeah.
I interviewed him and it was hilarious. I was so happy to make him laugh. That was the best part.
He was going crazy. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. So you were there for 3 years, and how did you exit?
I got another job. I got my own show. I got my own late night show.
The Pause?
Yeah. And so I left to do
that. How did that unfold? Did you pitch it?
No. I know. I have this weird, I hate telling these stories because it comes off so, like, I have this weird luck when it came to comedy, like when I just, stuff just worked out. And
it's not
weird,
luck if you can deliver the goods.
It's just worked out in a weird way, but I did my special 3 a.m. and.
For HBO?
For Netflix.
Okay.
And it was about to come out and people were like talking about it a little bit industry wise. And my manager kind of like leaked it to Princess Penny's people who had an overall deal with HBO, and he was trying to develop a late night show and he needed like a voice for his late night show. And she was like, I think Sam could be perfect for this. They showed him special. Princess's agent loved a special show. Princess's special. He was like, I love this. I want to meet her.
Yeah.
Me and Princess met. We talked to each other.
Who's this person?
Princess Penny. He is the EP of my show. He's the EP of Insecure.
Oh, okay.
And we vibed and we kept talking for like 2 weeks. And he was like, yeah, no, this is the person.
Yeah.
And he went to HBO and was like, this is the person. And HBO was like, yo, we love Sam. Like, she's dope.
Yeah.
Like, she's the shit. So this must be the person. And then at the same time, I got offered cast at SNL, like, while this is going on.
Oh, tough.
So I'm like, shit, like, what the fuck, you know? What am I going to do? Because SNL's my family. You know, at the end of the day, we really built something and bonded on something. And I had a great deal of like respect for everybody there.
Yeah.
And I loved working with everybody. And it also felt like a safe place. They kind of built me up.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the special would have been what it was without SNL and what I learned there. You know what I'm saying?
Of course, yeah.
And so it felt like I was really torn and I was trying to find some way to like do both some kind of way, but it was just kind of like, this is the thing I've always wanted to do, is like have my own product and kind of like form something the way I want to form it. And so I chose to do the show.
Well, it's interesting because like it must have been one of those things where the unknown is, can I, I'm going to have to do characters. I'm going to have to take a beat and learning how to do that. Right? You're like, you know, and you know, as opposed to I can engage my brain and my sense of humor every time I step into this thing.
Yeah.
But I can see how it would be tough.
Yeah, and I could make my own thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And also, I just didn't want to disappoint Lorne. You know, I know that that's his favorite thing. And when he offers it to you, it's a real, like, gesture for him.
Yeah,
and I just didn't want to disappoint him.
Did you, talk to him about it?
I did.
And?
It was okay.
Yeah?
It was okay.
He understood?
He understood. You know what I mean? And he told me, like, I always have a family there. You know, and I always have a place I could come
home
to.
But he's producing Bust Down, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and we're still...
You're back, kind of.
Yeah. We still together, you know?
So, but Pause, like, to me was... It's how often... So it was a weekly?
Yes.
And you only did, like, six?
Six, and now I'm doing eight.
Okay. Now, what's the production schedule on that thing? How long does it take to put that together? How do you decide? I mean, I know you have the kind of like, you know, drunky salon thing at your apartment. Is that really your apartment?
No.
Oh, it's okay.
I would not let camera and crew in my apartment.
but I like that. I mean, it's the way it feels obviously is unique, and then the kind of engaged people talking over each other, argument, you know, it's kind of fun. But obviously you decide on topics, right?
Yeah.
So how do you produce that? What's the idea?
I mean, we just get in the room and I throw out things that I'm feeling. It's a very talky room. The room pretty much feels like the party.
The writer room.
Yeah, yeah. The writer's room feels like the party.
Who's in there? How many people?
We got, I want to say we got 8 this year.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, we might have 10 this year and we had 8 last season.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mixed?
Yep. It's a lot. It's more women this season than men this season. And last season, I feel like it was pretty balanced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so when you're kicking around topics or whenever you're like, because like it seemed like the, and then you, in the writer's room, you kind of hash it out and then you decide, well, this is what we're going to talk about with the friends. And then you're like, so let's figure out what the out of studio segments are going to be
let's,
in relation to that.
Yeah, how do we make it active?
Yeah,
that's
what
we're always saying in the room. All right, this is just ideas now. Like, how do we make it active?
I thought it was provocative, again, as some middle-aged dude, you know, who's just trying to hold on to some relevance and not really knowing a lot. Like, there's just shit I don't know. Like, I've worked with, for a couple of years on radio, I had a black guy who was my partner on the mics. Mm-hmm. But like the idea, and obviously the idea of what is cooning or what is, you know, I've heard that, or tomming or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the actual, when you started talking about representing and how, and the challenge for you as a woman, as a gay person, and as a black person, I mean, that's like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And that conversation, I was like, well, I never thought about any of this shit. I mean, I'm learning things.
That's cool.
Well, how do you deal with that on a day-to-day basis? Or do you just surrender? Because at the end of the episode, you're like, I'm not that, and fuck it.
Yeah, I think that's how I deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, I just be me at the end of the day, and it's like, I don't know, you got to like take it or leave it type of deal, you know, because
You don't feel like it's a responsibility.
If I make it a responsibility, then I'm not being myself. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and it's
That's going to be your job.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't want that. You know what I mean? I want the ability to like even with pause, we always talked about it. Like, I want the ability to be wrong. I want the ability to grow. I don't want to be an authority. That's why we do it the way we do it. That's why I didn't want a desk. It was like, once you sit behind that desk, you're an authority. And now you have to know stuff and you have to be right. And it's like, that's just not actually my life experience. And sometimes I'm more connected to my blackness than my gayness. Sometimes I'm more connected to my gayness than my blackness. Sometimes I'm more connected to my feminine side than my masculine side. Sometimes I'm more connected to my masculine. Like, I'm just a multitude of things.
And sometimes you're just comedy.
And that's sometimes I'm a comic first, and that's it. Yeah. You know what I mean? And a lot of times, really, I feel like that's my ultimate identity, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just like, you can be a multitude of things, and sometimes those things are conflicting, and that's okay. I think we're so rigid these days, and it's like, that's not really how shit is.
Well, it's overthinky sometimes, and it's also in reaction. We live in reaction to other people dumping shit into our laps, because you can't stop people from dumping shit into your lap anymore. Like, everybody can get to everybody, and it doesn't take much to make someone go like, fuck, am I that? What did I do?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, they're nobodies.
Yeah, you just got to stop listening to people.
Right, but it's hard, right?
Yeah.
Every day I think like I'm getting off the, I'm just going to.
And then you're back on the junk, huh?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, bro.
That dopamine rush.
Yeah, I try not to be on it too, but it's like, you want to know, because you also make shit for people. So you do want to know what the fuck they think.
But then you realize a lot of people are just there to fuck things up.
Yeah, they're chaotic.
It's their hobby.
They're the Joker.
Hobby.
Yeah, they're the Joker. They're just
trolls.
Running around, burning shit down.
That's right. Thousands of them.
Yeah.
But I thought the conversations were really good, because it's not conversations I have or I'm privy to necessarily, but just also in terms of that whole representation thing leads into the next episode about, you know, how do you protect yourself in a world that you could be, your job could be affected by, you know, somebody finding something that you said taken out of context or misunderstood. I guess it's cancel culture, but I thought that was interesting too, because you're coming at that as somebody who wants a certain type of success, and you were able to separate the idea of black success versus regular success, and what success is, how it's dictated by white culture.
Yeah.
And that there's a different type of pressure, and there's a different type of bar to meet.
Yeah, a different type of like bartering system, you know, like it's a whole different, you're playing a whole different game, and you're trying to satisfy a lot of different things, because you still feel you have some responsibility, of course, to the black community.
Yeah.
It sounds the same thing of like, you have some responsibility to the minority group you're a part of, but you also like are trying to achieve something, and then also like you're just a fucking person. And like, you know, I always just think it's weird that people don't like realize we're just like people with jobs, right. You know, like,
I know
we're just people doing stuff,
kind of hard jobs.
Yeah. And we're just doing shit. And I get that there's an opportunity to make a lot of money doing it, but it's still just like a thing I'm doing, and I'm not always going to be correct or think the way you need me to think. And like, that's why there's a lot of us, and you should tap into the thing that's like servicing you at the time.
Sure.
And the thing that isn't, just don't fuck with it.
Right. And I think the challenge just becomes about, like, you know, how do I stay authentic and then not chase the expectation that, because there's so it, like this whole when you look at Kevin Hart, you know, was there a day that Kevin, and I know him and we've talked and I like him, but was there a day where he just sat down like, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to own this thing. The Kevin Hart brand, we're going to have breakfast cereal. We're going to have, I'm a motivational speaker. I'm going to do movies. I'm going to do athletics. I'm going to do stadiums. I mean, that business model is a real thing.
Yeah.
And people aspire to it.
Yeah, if that's what you want, you know what I mean? Like,
but I wouldn't know how to, it would be exhausting.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I
can't
do it.
Think in terms of relation to branding. Like, that's the whole, that seems to be the whole thing, and how you maintain any sort of sense of self or even authenticity when, you know, all your energy goes into branding. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
I'm old, though.
I don't really know what it is either. I think it's just like different. Like, some people come in and ask, everybody wants something different out this shit. And I just always wanted to be able to just create authentically. Yeah. Like, those were the motherfuckers I admired, and that's the shit I wanted to
do. Like, who?
Like, man, like Chappelle, like Rock, you know,
comics.
Carlin, like,
just,
I love fucking stand-ups, bro, you know, through and through. Damon Wayans, you know, I just wanted to be able to be myself, Patrice. I just wanted to be able to be, like, what I am.
Right.
And then, like, do shit.
Right, because that's what we fought for. That's our choice. It's like, I don't want anybody. I just want to find my space on that stage and own it.
Yeah.
And then whatever from there, as long as that's the core of it.
It's
I'm
a
good.
Little culty. Like, I always say, like, I'm just looking for my, like, tribe.
Right.
I'm just trying to talk. I'm talking into the ether, and I'm if it connects with you, like, come over here and we could chat.
Have you found, like, I'm starting to, because my audience came to me much later, but it's a very interesting, once you have an audience, to see what it's mostly made up of, and they sort of like, is that who I am inside? I guess so.
My
I guess
audience
I'm a,
is wild.
I guess I'm an angry middle-aged woman inside.
I think I'm like a half Republican white man. I get a lot of white dudes.
Really?
It's a weird mix with me. It's like a lot of white dudes, and then like a lot of older black men, like middle-aged to older black men, few black women in there, and then like young people. It's such a wild range.
Yeah. But you find that the people that are getting you deep, like, you know, because it's interesting when you have older grown-up people who come out, who seek you out, because that means you're speaking at least a mature language.
They
dig it. But it's hard to understand exactly why. Why do you say Republican?
Because I'm a bit rebellious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I play a lot. My material is very much, I push this way and I push that way.
Yeah.
And I'm not always left-leaning or right-leaning.
Right.
Depending on the topic. You don't really know where you're going to catch my opinion. And I think for, like, white dudes, they expect a thing. They're like, I know what that's going to be. Yeah. And then I start talking and they're like, I didn't know that that's what this was going to be.
Challenge them.
Yeah, right. So I think it's like a little bit like fun for them because like, oh, here's a path I didn't think anyone was going to take type of thing.
That's good. Well, I mean, I watched one segment that you did on Pause with the Black Republicans, Black Conservatives, and that woman came out. Did you not know?
Not know at all. Did not know at all.
How's she doing? All right.
She's good. She's out here living.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She's always like posting pictures like out. I'm like, okay, she's outside. That's cool.
That was kind of, you could feel the weight of that moment because you didn't even take it in for like a second. Like, wait, what?
Right.
This is happening?
I didn't, because I was just like, holy, this is crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the weird sort of line of self-actualization. It was interesting in that show that there is something about, you know, just, you know, black culture. And you just said about it earlier about, you know, taking yourself up by your bootstraps and doing, actualizing your life. And that's a conservative idea. I don't think it's necessarily Republican.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like conservative. Yeah. And I think that like white Republican dudes, they'll like hear some of that in me and be like, oh, I didn't know
they're like, oh, there's one that didn't need the welfare money.
Yeah, and it's like, that's not true.
Right. That's not what
you're saying.
And that's
what's fun about those like setups is that I also get to correct them. Like, no.
Right,
there's
right.
still this and there's still that. There is, I think, some power to give to Black people that like, you have to a little bit see it that way to beat the game.
Right.
To beat the game, you got to kind of decide.
Deprogram yourself from the welfare idea.
Yes. Yeah. Not the thing.
Right.
But the idea of the thing.
That's what we are.
Right.
Right.
And that's the only way you can. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like,
nah,
bro, there's you're really in control. It is really some like, I'm fucking a nerd, but I always say it's like some Matrix shit. It's just like, once you unplug and you're like, nah, I'm actually fully in control of this thing.
Right. Well, I think the real question with that kind of stuff politically is the idea of, is it a, you know, level playing field?
Not at all.
Right. So that is the argument against.
But it never will be.
Of course. Right.
So you just got to figure out how you level it.
Right. So do you accept that and play the victim, or do you try to rise above it?
And figure out to level it. And then when you do rise above it, how do you change it for the motherfuckers behind you so that they don't have to go through as much, you know?
Do you think that that is happening?
Yeah, I think especially with like, art and
exactly.
We're having art.
There's a lot of equality in fiction right now.
But I think it sets a standard and a thing. Like, I look at Pause and people will be like, some people will be like, yo, why do you say nigga so much? Why do you talk like that? And I'm like, yo, because that's how people where I'm from fucking talk. If I was sitting around talking to my friends, that's how we would speak. And if I change how I'm speaking, because now I'm in this white space necessarily, then I'm making it harder for the niggas from where I'm from to come in and be who they are.
Right.
Now they have to pose a posture. And some of these motherfuckers can't.
Right.
Like, truly and honestly, they can't.
Yeah.
So it's like, if I put on airs for you motherfuckers, I'm not helping them.
Right. Right.
I'm just keeping the status quo.
That's right. You're saying like, look, I managed to fit into this space.
Yeah, and it's like, nah, fuck that. Break the space. Once you get in it, break the space.
Right, right. And that's it. You can definitely feel that.
I'm trying, bro. I don't know. I don't know how well it's doing.
What do you mean? I mean, what's the feedback? I mean, who's saying you use the N-word too much?
Black people and white people. I think anytime you're doing something that's, you know.
Yeah.
What it is, it's going to...
It's just like, but it, like, I don't know why I don't process it that way. You know, I don't know, you know, I completely felt right away. I'm like, all right, this is, you know, this is the way that this community is talking. So get on board. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, slow it down if you need to and figure out what's happening. How are they engaging? And again, I'm not saying they as Black people, but this community, if this is the language, so figure it out.
Yeah.
And it's provocative.
And they as Black people, they as young people.
Right, exactly.
They as gay people.
Gay people, exactly.
You know, exactly. And I'm just a firm believer in like that there's not a... I don't want to play those games anymore. I feel like the Black people before us, they did all that dancing for y'all niggas.
Yeah.
They did all the dancing they could do, bro, and it still didn't do shit.
Right.
So I'm not...
Oh, that's interesting.
We're not doing that.
They worked the white space, and we're still stuck.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, no.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But it's very exciting in a way because I like how there's, in conversation, the volume level and the level of interruption and engagement is exciting. Like, if you get through the way, because it's obviously structured, the show, right? You know, you guys are riffing, but, you know, once you learn the language of the show, it's like, it is a completely new approach to that late night idea. This is the monologue. There's 20 of us.
Yeah.
And we're talking.
Well, I just tried to, like, for me, it's like, it gotta feel like I'm a fucking stand-up, bro. I'm used to yelling at people over people at the Cellar. I'm used to screaming at Keith to make my point.
Yeah,
and it was like, bro, if you take away all that energy, then I'm not even being my authentic self. And
because you're self-checking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then it's not real. And
right,
it's like,
right.
Bro, I was very clear, like, I want to fight for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's how I usually have to make a point. I gotta fight for it.
Right.
And I want people to scream over me. I want someone to be more right than me sometimes.
Right,
and I'm like, all right, you walk right, like when Ricky has that moment, it's like, I hope we get more of those this season. Like, okay, bro.
Well, that was funny about you and Ricky. It's like he was like the only guy you listened to.
But he's a guy I'm always yelling at.
I know, but it was something because there was one moment where you're just like, he's talking and you're not saying nothing. I'm like, wow, they're friends.
Yeah, we're actually friends.
But what's okay, so we can talk about, bust down a little bit. But before we do that, what are some of the topics you're thinking at kicking around for the pause? You produce that out of New York?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Pause season 2. I mean, we're just getting more personal, you know? We felt like that Titties Out episode was like our...
Yeah.
Like, this is the goal.
Right.
This is when the show feels absolutely correct.
When you're not trying to take on, the black responsibility angle.
Yeah. And I'm like existing in the existence, if you will.
Right.
And so this season, it's like a lot of personal stuff. I'm doing an episode about jail that's kind of surrounding my brother went to jail when I was very young and he was young. I'm doing this episode.
Is he out?
Yeah. I'm doing this episode around death and how my mother died so young, like my fear of death and how I haven't really overcome it. And
so you're doing that same give or take crew?
Yep.
Talking about personal stuff.
Different comics this season.
Uh-huh.
So a bunch of different people outside of Jack and Zach who are like my core boys.
Yeah.
We're going to bring a bunch of different comics and we're going to break it a little bit again. We're going to have some fun and restructure some things.
Yeah.
And sometimes it won't start at the party. You know, we're going to do some cool stuff.
Okay. And with Bust Down, how did that come together?
Chris Red brought us a project. He was the only one out of all four of us that was actually making money at the time and had any type of traction out in the industry.
Yeah.
And he had this opportunity to redevelop something that was a show out in, I want to say Canada. It was like about four friends who made a pact to not have sex. And then that's how they get through life, holding each other accountable to this pact.
Yeah, right.
And he was like, yo, do y'all think we could mess with this and kind of like make it us? And we were like, and he was like, you can get some money. And we was like, cool, we don't got nothing to do.
Yeah.
So we started with that. And of course, it grew completely away from that to what it became. And we just kept jamming on it. It's been 5 years in the making.
Really?
5.5.
It's an odd space that show happens in, right? Because there's part of me, and again, I've only watched the pilot, and I'm sure it gets different.
Yeah.
But there is that sense of like, are we supposed to take this real, or is this just a comedy space? How do you look at it?
It's totally just for yucks.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right,
and I think at first, when people watch the pilot, because it's such a heavy topic, but we thought it was a cool way to introduce who we all are.
That was a heavy
be.
Topic. To male molestation. it's like if you're gonna do like the pilot's got to be about being molested when you're a dude and how you handle that.
Yeah, and how people react to that.
Yeah,
but we thought it was a good way to tell who each character was gonna be throughout this series, and also a good way to let people know, yo, these are the type of swings we're gonna be taking.
Right.
So if you're in for this, you're in for the ride. If you're not in for this, then get out now. If you're not gonna laugh at young Chris getting his dick sucked, then this probably isn't the show for you.
Who's not going to laugh at young Chris getting his dick sucked? The character he plays is very odd. He just really commits to it.
Yeah. I think Chris is such a great silly Billy.
You can
really throw him in anything, and he's gonna silly it up.
And you guys are all writing it, you and Jack and Chris.
And Langston, yeah. And we have a writer's room. Emmy Blotnick, Gary Richardson's in that thing.
From SNL?
Zach Fox. Yeah.
And so now that you're doing the premiere, and then you go back and get to work on Pause.
Yep.
And that's it. Stand-up, doing it?
Yes. I want to do another special next year.
I've been hammering this shit out for like 6 months, the new stuff, putting the new hour together. You?
I've been working the cellar and just getting like these chunks I like and going like, I like this, you know? I think this could be something.
Right.
Like, I like this and I think this could be something. I want to do some more theater stuff. I might do a run. I am going to do a run at the Cherry Lane where I can really like sit some stuff.
Yeah, I just like, I'll get like a residency at Dynasty Typewriter and just do like 4 Tuesdays.
Yeah.
And just riff it out.
Yeah.
See what sticks.
That's what I'm trying to do. And just like really sit in some stuff and really start to
What's going on with the Cherry Lane? I mean, it seems like I remember when I used to do one-man shows that most of the road guys, most of the comics were like, oh yeah, you're giving up, huh? But now it seems to be a thing. So are they offering the space to workshop as well? Or are you planning on doing a one-person, more structured thing?
I'm lucky enough to have an agent that really has a good relationship with them. So I'm going to do some workshopping.
Well, that's the way to go, man.
It's going
to
be it's going to have its legs a little bit, but it's going to be more of a workshop.
So you're going to, like, instead of like you're running it as like a theatrical run fully produced, you're going to like do some nights where you're just kind of trying to put shit together?
Yeah.
Reasonably price ticket?
Yeah. Not crazy, because I'm just putting stuff together.
Yeah.
But I just want that I want that theater audience because there's some complicated ideas.
Yeah.
And I need some space to really like...
Yeah. Have the support.
Tease them out.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, and theater audience is like,
Yeah. And, you know, we at the cellar, it's like, you better blah, 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 blah.
No, the cellar, it's like, you know, people don't realize, you know, as much as we all talk about it, that is not a fucking easy room.
Nah.
There's nothing easy about it. You can't get away with anything there. And if you're too sensitive, like if you're trying to show that part of yourself,
Yeah, you
wrong
gotta,
place.
Yeah, you gotta balance it right. It's a dance there.
How is it over there?
I love it.
I've been avoiding it.
No, I love it.
I mean, I came up in there. I know all those guys, but like, I just, it's weird. I went in there and no one was there and I didn't go on. I should just go back. I always have this.
Have you done the VU? The Village? I like
once,
that room the best.
Once,
that's
yeah.
my favorite room.
It's just when I go to New York, I'm usually doing something else and like, I don't feel the love as much as I used to, but I might just be making that up.
I think you might be making that up.
I'm
bro.
Sure, man. I'm just another paranoid comic.
I think if you showed up,
yeah, it's like with you backstage. Like it's sort of like, what the fuck is her problem? So, what are these difficult things that you're going to be exploring?
I mean, I want to do this shit about like, it's weirdly right now. I'm calling it like a love letter to America from a person that shouldn't love America. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
That's all I have right now, and it has some of that Manifest Destiny stuff in it, and it has some of this like relationship that the core relationship that I think in this country, which is black and white people, and then how that like reflects outward to the rest of like the world,
yeah.
and then like how that kind of affects how this country like operates in a way that we don't want to acknowledge, and that at the end of the day it is just a relationship.
Yeah.
It's just a relationship between us. Uh-huh. A pretty toxic one.
Right.
But just a relationship at the end of the day that we haven't quite figured out how to navigate. And both of us have some stake in that.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've been relating it to an abusive relationship.
Mm.
And I'm like,
so it's clearly that.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, like black people, we have to accept that where the bitch getting beat. So we have some of those tendencies of wanting to be liked and wanting the approval. And we hope white people will come home one day and say, I'm sorry, honey, you know,
right,
you're
right,
perfect.
Right.
And I should have never hit you. And
let's
the only reason
counseling.
I do is because I'm broken. And
yeah, right.
Let's go fix it. And like a part of us is we may need to accept that they never are going to do that. But we also have to accept that we actually want that. And we have to be honest about the fact that we fucking want that. And white people got to be honest about the fact that they are fucking abusers and that this has been a bad ride for niggas. You know what I mean? Like, period. And like, just really exploring this kind of heavier stuff and then kind of how that connects to like people, foreign people who come here from other countries and their views and perceptions of this and how America's kind of a gambler's island. But in that, there's some beauty in it because it does give space kind of for everybody in this weird way.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think you like in Pause, you kind of, I thought pretty well comedically addressed this idea of, you know, it's a known idea if you're progressive or you're educated that the Constitution was not for black people.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but the idea of making a black Constitution was very funny.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like even in that, I think I think about the Constitution and I'm like, well, what makes it so beautiful is because it is a document that was made by persecuted people.
Uh-huh.
And so in its language, it includes all people, but only a persecuted person would even think to create that language.
That's right.
To say all people is because they've been ostracized at some point. So it's like this happy little mistake.
Yeah.
And because this is like the core of this is persecuted people trying to find their freedom.
Right.
When someone pushes back hard enough and long enough, eventually it folds because it's like,
we got to add some shit.
We got to add some shit. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's well-intended. But it's not covering everything.
Right.
Things are changing.
Right.
Well, that sounds great. And, you know, good luck with it. And I will see you in New York.
Yeah, man.
Good talking to you.
This was good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great. There you go. We learned. I did. I learned. Sorry if I was nervous or whatever I was. It worked out. Comic to comic. Me and Sam J. Season 2 of Pause with Sam J is coming to HBO in May. You can stream all of Season 1 on HBO Max. I recommend it. And now I'm going to play some guitar.
Boomer lives. Monkey in La Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.